We're going to have a speaker who got sober in this group when he was in high school. Didn't think he was going to make it, but doing great. I'd like to welcome Eric.
Thank you. I'm Eric, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 3rd, 2006. My home group, like Jim mentioned, is this group. It's a sponsorship group. We meet every Sunday night tonight. And we also have another meeting throughout the week where we go out on jails, rehabs, and institutions, which he also mentioned. And I've been doing that ever since I've been sober, and it's made it really easy for me to stay sober that way. My experience is that I didn't always think I was alcoholic. I always had problems growing up, and I never equated them to alcoholism. I always knew I was different than everyone else growing up. I always had this feeling of difference ever since I was probably 6 years old. And I remember times where I'd be walking around and just constantly stuck in my head. Like, I could not get out of it. Like, I couldn't stop wondering what other people were thinking about me. And it was very strange because it wasn't really that strange, but it was most like, more often than not, most people weren't even noticing me because I was trying not to be noticed. I didn't want any attention. I didn't want to create any waves. I had a lot of fear growing up, and by the time I was 13 years old, I was ready for a drink. And oh my God, when I started drinking, it was a relief. I went to this party, and I was very nervous, and which was my normal state of being, and I had rehearsed a couple of conversations in my head of what I was going to say to people that I thought were going to be there, and I got there, and no one was there that I thought was going to be there, except for my cousin who came with me, I just felt so out of place that it was, I wish I was anywhere else besides that party. I remember thinking to myself, this was a bad idea, I shouldn't have come. You know, this is stupid. And everyone was drinking Heineken beers, and I had my first Heineken that night, and it tasted nasty. It didn't taste that good at all. I didn't like it at all. And but I started choking it down, and my whole goal at this party was to impress these cool kids there. And I'm trying to keep a straight face while drinking this Heineken down, I didn't look that cool. But in my mind, I thought, you know, I think I can pull this off. And I'm making all these, like, squinty, like, ugh, like, I'm trying not to puke. It's like, eventually I gave up on, like, not worrying about making the faces, and I was just trying not to, like, make a scene. And I don't remember exactly how many drinks it took in. It took for me to feel this different feeling, but maybe it was around the third one, or maybe it was around the fourth one. But after a couple of drinks, I felt this sense of ease and comfort that came over me. And man, it felt good. I started getting this little bit of a buzz feeling going on. And I had been trying to time my conversations appropriately with everyone else's. And after three or four drinks later, I just started jumping in whatever. And that caused some raised eyebrows because I have a tendency to really think out conversations a little bit far ahead. And for me, I always had a bad time in growing up. Actually, I probably still have it now. But when I started hanging out, when I was at this party, and people were talking about, you know, football and whatnot, I started bringing up about, you know, things that they were talking about 5 minutes ago about, like, dancing and whatnot. And it never seemed like I could fit in before, and I would always be nervous to even try. And but what drinking did for me was it made me have a sense of ease and comfort that I just didn't care how it was timed and whatnot. And, you know, from what I can recall the rest of the night, nothing major happened in the sense of later on in my drinking, like it did then. But I do vaguely remember having a couple conversations that night and waking up the next morning and thinking to myself, I gotta do that again. I don't care when, I don't care where, you know, I've got to try that again. And you know, I look forward to drinking after that point. And about a month later, I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And it wasn't because I was alcoholic at the time. I went there because my cousin, who's a month younger than me, was starting to get sober. And as I started drinking, he was starting to get sober. And I went to my first meeting, and oh, God, the circus was in town. I went to this AA clubhouse, and as we were walking in, I knew I was in the wrong place. I knew this AA stuff wasn't going to be for me, because I noticed this long line of Harley-Davidson motorcycles parked out front. And as I'm walking in and we're going through the door, I get hit by a huge wall of smoke, and I hear people screaming and cursing each other out on the inside. And I could have sworn, my cousin says I'm lying, but I could have sworn I saw a chair fly across the room. And I looked around, I saw muscles, I saw tattoos, I saw piercings from ear to toe, and that was just the women in AA. And I felt very awkward and out of place, and that was my first introduction to AA. And I sat, it turned out to be a beginner's meeting. Well, it split off to a bunch of other meetings, but I went with my cousin to a beginner's meeting where we sat around a table and chain-smoked cigarettes throughout the whole meeting, and we read a story in the back of the book. And then everyone got a chance to share about, you know, a little bit about themselves. And as the went around the room, I was probably about halfway in the center of the room, so I was going to be like right there. And before it even got to me, I knew this AA stuff was not for me, because I sat there and I listened to how alcohol had ruined these people's lives. You know, how it has stolen their job, their wife, their kids, and how they lost everything to alcohol. And at that time, at 13 years old, when I started drinking, I felt like it did the exact opposite for me. It felt like it gave me the power to get those things in my life to begin with. And because other up and by myself sober, I'm just such a mess. I can't even fathom how to even get a girlfriend at that time, let alone a wife, you know. And so by the time it got to me, I just said, you know, I'm with him. I was pointing to my cousin. It went on. And I listened throughout the rest of the meeting. And the only thing I really got from it at that point was like, well, if my drinking ever gets so bad that I get arrested, I might do this AA thing. And I just kind of kicked it in the back of my mind. And from that point on, it was one of the things that started haunting my drinking, or at least my mornings when I'd come to. Because I had this these strange experiences. Because after that visit to AA, I had kept on drinking. And I had a couple of episodes just right off the bat that were a little bit strange that got me to kind of question my drinking. And one of them was I went camping with my other cousin. And, I vaguely remember most of it. But what I do recall is I started drinking. I found myself on the handlebars of a bicycle. One second, the next second, we're falling down. And then I came to again, and I found myself in the middle of a field. And that's not too abnormal for me, so I just kept on going. And then the next time I came to, there was this tall guy screaming and cursing me out, just angry as heck, muscles the size of my head, and naturally I ran away. I felt a draft, I looked down, and I saw my fly was open, and I was going to the bathroom. I looked back, and I see this kid has this long streak down his leg of where I accidentally peed on his leg, and obviously that's why he was a little bit upset. And being the smart aleck that I am, I decided to give him some advice of not wear camouflage pants when we're camping, that he looks like a tree then. And he didn't have a sense of humor because he started chasing me. But, I mean, that was my first rough call right after AA. And the next morning, I had all these lectures to endure from all my friends saying that I drank too much and that I need to, like, slow down, that I need to not drink so much. And thank God Patrick was there. Oh, I mean, he saved my life, because he said, you know what your problem is, Eric? You got to stay away from beer. You go to the bathroom way too much when you drink that stuff. Stick with Bacardi, man. And I love this kid. I mean, he kind of became my drinking sponsor at that point. And he used to give me all this great advice when it came to drinking. And I really learned about percents and proofs and whatnot about drinking. I discovered, you know, like the what not to mix and what to mix. And because before I would just mix everything in a Poland Spring bottle. I didn't care. But when I found out about hard liquor and whatnot, I love that a lot better. Because beer, when I was 15 years old, beer wasn't really drinking anymore. You know, it wasn't. I mean, by the time I was 15 years old, I had fallen in love with alcohol. You know, I love that feeling that alcohol gave me. It gave me the strength that I needed to be able to face my life. And the ironic thing it wasn't like I grew up in a broken household or anything. I grew up in Summit, right next town over. And, I had two loving parents that gave me everything that I needed to succeed in life. And I just was not driven. I just did not really have any goals or didn't want it to do anything. I mean, I could have been happy just pumping gas for the rest of my life. And, then when I found out about drinking, I was like thinking, well, if I can make a lot of money while pumping gas, that would be great because then I could do a lot of drinking. And, it didn't have anything to do from where I came from when it came to alcoholism. And, by the time I was 15, I kind of stopped hanging out around with my geeky friends that I used to hang out with all the time, and I started hanging out with cooler kids, and then I stopped hanging around with kids in Summit because they started catching on that my drinking was not really that normal. There's only a couple times that you can kind of come to, because I had this problem where I wouldn't remember things, and I don't know how this happened, how these nights would unfold most of the time. Most of my stories actually hearsay. But I could tell you what happened when I woke up. One time I woke up, I was half naked with my shirt on. Luckily, I had my cell phone in my hand. And there was times where I wake up and I was in my bed and I was perfectly fine. And I was like, it was a good night. and then there was times I would start trying to call people, trying to figure out what happened before. And people would, more often than not, would not answer. But there was a lot of people that would call and say, you have some gall to actually call me up tonight, after last night. And so I had a couple of those experiences. And you know what? If that's all it took, I probably never would have gotten sober. Because that's just a small price to pay for the way I felt on the inside. And I could, in fact, when I was 16 years old, and I'd pretty much burned most of my bridges of where people didn't want to hang out with me, as long as I could get wasted, it didn't matter. It actually, I'd made it a lot more fun, because I was able to drink the way I wanted to. I didn't have to, hide it. I didn't have to pretend like I was in control. And I absolutely loved that feeling. And I had done some drinking with my older brother on occasion, And I remember I used to have this argument in my head of like, this is why I need to keep on drinking. This is the thing that keeps me socially connected with other people. And that theory went out the window when I ended up staying locked up in my room drinking and doing coke all night long and not going to school the next day. And so it doesn't really seem to work for my social skills after that. But consequences that I started facing in life, a lot of them were not even so much what happened when I was drinking. But I'd make these promises to my friends, and I had some good friends left. And they hadn't seen the worst of what I had done, and I had always kept that part of my life hidden from them. I didn't want them to know. And I was convinced that if I can get the girl, if I can be cool, if I can just, get everything that everyone else has on the outside, then I would be all right on the inside, like everyone else is. Because I go to Summit High School, I see kids that are complaining about not being able to take the porch to school and whatnot. I'm not even aiming for that high. I'm just looking for, a girlfriend or just anything to make me feel normal. And I started chasing that, and I got very active in academics, and I became very studious in the sense I wasn't smart or anything like that, but I was very obsessive when it came to studying. And I would study for hours nights before the test and be able to pull off a B and just curse myself a loser because I couldn't get the A. And then most of the time, more often than not, I'd eventually get the A. But it just wasn't enough because I would get, even when I got the A, or the best was, a better example is I would get the B and my dad would say that I could do better. And I would think in my head, it still doesn't work. I do all these things in life and I still don't feel all right. And I started trying to be cool and I went totally the wrong direction for that at first. I went to the theater department, which is definitely not the best place to go if you want to start acting cool. Um, But I did the smart thing. I did the behind-scenes stuff with the lighting crew, because that's what my older brother did. And my older brother was always cool. And I started doing that obsessively. And I joined the construction crew because in the construction crew, it was me, the male tech director, and six girls. I mean, come on, attraction rather than promotion here. And it was one of those things that it was great, because it was like I got a chance to actually hang around with other people. And with what I discovered early on in the theater department is they like to drink as much as I like to drink, some of them at least. And they would have cast parties and after cast parties. And then I would be hosting the after cast party at 3 a.m. in the morning, driving around somewhere. And those were times that I thought, you know, at those times I felt like I had arrived. I felt like I had finally achieved something. But after a week or two of that, it would eventually start wearing on me, where I would start thinking to myself, that's it? Is that it to it? And I started picking up a new direction, a new obsession, and I figured that in order to be cool, that I needed to start up a band, and so I started playing the drums and whatnot, and all this ties into my alcoholism, because I just, you know, it didn't seem to matter what I did, but it wasn't never enough. You know, there was always another level to do, and so by the time I started up this band, I'd fallen in love at least three times at this point, and kind of made myself the Hallmark hopeless romantic at that point, I'd finally found my true love at this point, and I'm rolling my eyes right now for the people that are listening, but I started up this band, and we were not good at first, but we finally got lucky when this guy came into the band who actually had musical talent, and then it actually started getting somewhere. And we started playing gigs, and it was fun, because we would play the gigs, and this kid that was musically talented, he was completely straight edge. He didn't drink, he didn't do drugs. I don't know what the heck what was wrong with him, and he had, like, this huge house he lived in Summit, and, like, I think, like, eight brothers and sisters, so, like, the house was filled. And I remember hanging out with this kid, and, like, he was, like, the textbook normal type of guy, where he would be saying the craziest things of, like, you know, oh, I gotta get home and do my homework tonight. And so it's like, wait, what? Why even bother? And he didn't even drink. So when we were hanging out and we played the concert, I'm like, you want to go drinking? And he'd be like, no, I can't. I'm not 21 yet. And I would just be awestruck, like, wait, what? Wait, you know, if you don't get caught, it's not illegal. And when I started hanging out with people like that, or when they started finding me in life, I started realizing that maybe my drinking wasn't exactly normal. And I had periods of times before even hanging out with him and hanging out with people like him that I wanted to stay sober, that I tried to stay sober. And like I said, you know, if only I could manage everything right, I would be able to stay sober. But those times, I never stayed sober, because I would always convince myself one way or another that I could drink safely. More often than not, I would think to myself, well, you know what? It's Friday night. Two beers is not really drinking. If I have two beers tonight and I shut it down at that, I'll be fine for tomorrow, right? And I have those two beers, and then this phenomenon of craving takes over. And I don't even realize it's happening. But what I can equate it to is like this feeling that I get, like this off to the races feeling, where something just clicks inside me when I had those couple of drinks, where my thinking changes from I'm shutting it down at the second one, going, well, Eric, you've been so hard on yourself so lately, you know, you deserve a little break. You can have three tonight. And it's like I'm giving myself permission to have another one. And then I have the third one, and I'm like, you know what? One more won't kill me. We only live once. And I have the fourth one. And by that point, I start losing track of what's going on around me. And I start waking up in bushes again, and waking up half naked again. And so by the time I reached 16 years old, I had more than willing to want to stay sober, And I'd gone to AA meetings before, and I'd felt like, because I'd gone to a bunch of various meetings, I went to step meetings, I went to discussion meetings, I went to speaker meetings, I went to some other kinds of meetings as well, but I can't remember which ones exactly. But I figured, since I've gone to all the different types of meetings, and my cousin stayed sober throughout this whole experience, and he's still sober to this day, but I would go to meetings with him, and I knew him and I were different, because, you know, he would be crazy as hell before the meeting, and then we'd go to the meeting, and I'd see him talking to some, like, old guy or whatnot, and I never wanted to figure out what was going on, but I kind of know now, from hindsight, you know, he was probably talking to his sponsor. But he would always seem, like, a little bit different after the meeting, and he would go home, and he would do a little writing in some paper, and then call his sponsor, and then pray and go to bed. And he would be all right with himself. And that didn't seem like that was going to work for me. And I kept on telling myself that won't work for me. You know, because I went to the same meeting as him. I was imitating what he was doing to some extent, not fully. And I didn't feel like I was getting any results, so therefore I didn't think I was alcoholic because of it. And I had to ask him one day, you know, I finally got tired of wondering in my mind, but I had to ask him why he started believing in God. Because my cousin had a little bit of a history of being a tough guy who didn't take any criticism from anyone. He kind of, you know, just my idolized, you know, like, tough guy, like, badass that I always wanted to be in life. And, you know, he actually was. And all of a sudden, he started getting sober, and he started talking about God. And I felt like he got brainwashed. And I finally asked him, I was like, why do you believe in God? And he told me this story about how when he was sober, he tried killing himself with a bottle of pills. And how this night unfolded was he kept on puking, even though he was trying to stop himself from puking. He couldn't stop himself, and he believed God saved him that night. And, you know, and I didn't believe in God after hearing that, but what I equated it to was that, you know, he felt miserable enough sober that he wanted to kill himself. And I could identify with that. And I could identify with that, because I started staying up until 3 a.m., sometimes even 4 a.m. in the morning, going to bed, waking up at like 6 to go to school the next day, and just completely distraught because I was up all night long, just couldn't stop thinking sober. I just couldn't stop, and my head just kept on racing, and I became suicidal. And so when I heard that, and when I heard him describing that, that's what I kind of equated the fact that I might be alcoholic. And I started doing those meetings on my own, and I never got a sponsor because I used the rationale of that I was smart enough not to need a sponsor in AA, and I figured I was different. And that was absolutely ridiculous looking back now, but I was convinced of it. And so, almost needless to say, I got drunk again and 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 again. And it didn't matter what I tried. It didn't matter who I hung out with. It didn't matter what I said, how much I, you know, started praying. You know, I'd always eventually stop praying. I'd always, you know, stop believing. And I'd always get bored sober. And I just couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand thinking about staying sober for the rest of my life. I was like, I'm not even legal enough to drink. I'm not old enough legally to drink, and I can't imagine staying sober. And so when I felt at that point, when I got into that point, I had things started changing. And it was around my sobriety date, August 3rd, 2006. I had just gotten back from a little trip that I took, and I started going to meetings again with my cousin. I heard the same things I heard in every single meeting that I went to before. It was the exact same things, you know, and it kind of just ruined it for me in a sense. There was no more like that honeymoon period where I would be sitting in a meeting and listening and go like, oh, that sounds profound, that sounds amazing. I'm like sitting there going like, I heard that before, yeah, whatever. You know, it was done. I was just like, I couldn't stand it anymore. In fact, I didn't want to go. But my cousin was saying, dude, you're too freaking crazy not to go tonight, go. And apparently I was so crazy that my cousin couldn't even keep up with me, so he'd have to send his friends to drag me to more meetings. And I went to a bunch of other fellowships, and I was just absolutely nuts out of my mind. I could not get comfortable in my own skin. And I was going to all these meetings, and I was thinking, there's something seriously wrong with me. I remembered the year before when this happened, I actually drank while I was in this, when I was staying with my cousin and my uncle. And they have a completely sober house, and I had stashed in some Listerine just because I think it makes my breath taste and smell a lot better. And I ended up freaking out one night and ended up drinking that, and I said I'd never do that. And, you know, the desperation drove me to do things of that nature. And so when I got to that point again next year, I was so out of sorts. And then I got the wonderful news that the girlfriend that I was seeing at the time had cheated on me with the bassist in the band. About next month or so, I got kicked out of the band. And luckily, before I got kicked out of the band, I went to a meeting where my sponsor found me. And this guy could tell I was new. I had the deer in the headlights look, and he said I looked so pathetic. I had to be new. And the funny thing was, I thought I was dressed cool for this meeting. You know, I thought I had it together. I even convinced my mom to let me borrow like the Avalon, the nice Toyota Avalon, to bring to the meeting. I was a mess apparently, and but my first sponsor, you know, he introduced me to this group, and he introduced me to the principles and the steps, and what he taught me was, you know, that, you know, I had to do this stuff every single day, that I had to take actions on a daily basis, no matter how I felt or what I wanted to do, and I didn't really want to hear that at first, but I was fine with that. And he said, you know, Eric, you got to do the little things. That's important. Because otherwise you'll start catching resentments. And then when you start catching resentments, you'll start to drift away from AA. And then once you start drifting away from AA, you're a lot closer to a drink. And the drink is to die. And I thought to myself, if only I was that lucky. And about a month or so later, after about a month hanging around with this guy, him taking me through the steps, I was on my amends process. I had made most of my major amends since it was, luckily enough, right in my neighborhood. I didn't move anywhere, so it was pretty easy to make those amends. When he ended up starting drifting away and started catching little resentments and whatnot, he just proved exactly what he said was true through his own actions. And when I got my second sponsor, you know, he taught me a lot about this program, where it came to being real and lowering one's guard. Because I never thought I was alcoholic when I got here. I really was trying to convince myself that I might be alcoholic at first, when I was first going to my couple meetings. And some of the things that I started hearing that I never paid attention to before, I started feeling like I could identify with. A lot of them I heard when spoken at behind this podium and in other places as well. But there was this one time, I think it was the week after I met my sponsor, he said, meet us at some Starbucks at 3 p.m. It was a Saturday. I'm thinking, oh, sweet. We'll go to like an early meeting tonight. I get to go home and I get to play video games. This is going to be awesome. So I go to Starbucks, and there's like six other guys there already, right? I'm thinking, oh, this is strange. And I kind of know them. I don't remember their names because I'm a little bit too self-consumed at the time. And a white Ford Explorer pulls up, and the doors open up, and the guy goes inside, goes, get in. And all six of us shuffle into this Explorer, and I get crammed in all the way in the back because I was the newest guy there, one of the newest guys there. We started driving. And these guys started talking about fears, and they started talking about secrets, and they started talking about things that I just didn't even feel comfortable hearing. I'm thinking, okay, I've done the same things, but we don't need to talk about this now. And these guys were actually not only just talking about it, they weren't even whispering. They were like shouting and joking about this. And oh my God, I felt it was very strange. And I started looking out my window thinking, like, where the heck is this meeting? And I look out, and it's like, welcome to Pennsylvania. I'm like, oh, crap. Oh my God. And I heard my, at that time, it was my sponsor speak. And he shared that night, and we did a third step before the meeting around this cherry, and I had no idea what we were doing. I hadn't even done a third step at that point, or maybe I had, or I didn't recall it. And but we did the third step. We went into the meeting, and he spoke for the whole hour. And I was dumbfounded by the fact that I'd never heard once before someone describe alcoholism when they were like 6 years old. And it like blew my mind because I was like, oh my God, I was the exact same way. And he talked about things of like being nervous, a wreck about giving book reports and whatnot. And I was thinking, I kept on identifying. I was like thinking, maybe I might be alcoholic. And after that point, I started hearing even more and more things that kind of proved the fact that I was alcoholic. And I thought my whole life that I, with my drinking, I never hurt anyone else besides myself, I thought at first, until I did a fourth and fifth step. And my first fourth and fifth step, I had heard all this, all these things about it, about it being so difficult to write a fourth step. And when I started hearing about these things, I was actually halfway written it at that point. So it was kind of like, I was really confused about if I was doing the step right or not, because I was going through the steps quickly. And by the time I had that done, I read it to my sponsor. I went home that night and I read some things out of the big book that he told me to read and sat for an hour and then went to bed. And the craziest thing happened to me that night, and that's the only reason why I brought all this up. When I went to sleep that night, I stopped tossing and turning. I no longer fought to try to fall asleep. I ended up waking up the next morning relaxed and actually happy. And that was shortly lived, but it was one of those things that gave me hope. That I was like, maybe there is something to this stuff. Maybe there is something out there that might be able to help me. Because when it came to this, when it came to my early sobriety, I was very skeptical about this whole thing. And I figured that in my mind, I kept on telling myself that I was going to do it. And when it didn't work, I'll do it my way again. And sometimes I wish I can convince myself of that again. Because I can't seem to stop doing it my way these days a lot of times. But, it was an adventure. It was a crazy time. And I hung around with people that were absolutely crazy. And they looked at me and they thought I was crazier than them. And and when I started opening my mouth, I think they were right. Because I had this thing where when I got sober, I didn't really like talking. I didn't want people to find out that much about me because I never really liked myself. You know, I never liked myself when I was six. You know, and growing up, it never got any better. I never really looked at myself in the mirror and like, you know, did the whole flexing thing. I'd look in the mirror and just start walking away crying, you know, because I just had like no, there's like low self-esteem and then there's no self-esteem. And so when I got to AA, I thought I had no self-esteem, and my sponsor told me that I had pride. And I'm thinking, is this guy nuts? And he said, you have reverse pride. You know, I was just like, oh, jeez. And he had me do things and talk to people and communicate with people, and he would challenge me upon my thinking about, like, hanging around with people that were still drinking. And I thought I could still hang around with my friends like that. And at that time, I had no idea what I was doing or what was really going on. And I was actually very fortunate because when I got kicked out of the band, when the girlfriend had cheated on me and all those bad situations had happened, it had caused like a series of domino effect of like this, like all my friends like started burning bridges with me like left and right. It was like boom, 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 boom. Like the next second it felt like I was looking around and all that was left was like all these AA people. I was just like, all right. And even then, I wasn't enthused about going to meetings or about sharing or about anything like that because I was so wrapped up in my head and even going through the steps. So much so that my sponsor on a daily basis had to always encourage me to help others, always. And he kept on pushing me to and pushing and pushing and pushing. And eventually, I started going out willingly to want to do this because I had started going to some meetings and I started opening up and being honest in my shares. I had this bad tendency to lie at the podium a couple times, and well, namely at some detoxes and whatnot, because I kind of wanted to impress these guys that were closer to my age and make my drinking sound a lot tougher than it was. And that never really did. It didn't help anybody. And it really, I felt like it did a lot more damage that way. And when I got that second sponsor that I was mentioning before, you know, he was the one that really pushed me to be able to share openly and honestly about myself, about, you know, who I really was. And he always had the strangest analogies when it came to anything. I mean, he always had an analogy for something. And this one time, I'm talking to him about how I was, like, nervous to share. And he was like, you know what, Eric, you remember, have you ever seen the movie 8 Mile? I'm like, oh, God, no. And I was like, yeah, I've seen it, and I didn't really like it. But he goes, you know, when Eminem at the end talks, you know, does the rap thing, you know, and he talks about, you know, all the bad things about himself, so the guy has nothing to, like, criticize him about. And I was like, yeah. He's like, well, I want you to do that tonight. And I was thinking, that just makes no sense. And I remember the movie, and I remember listening to my sponsor share at the podium plenty of times about himself. And I figured, what the heck, and I gave it a shot, and I stuttered and stammered through my talk this night, and it was an hour-long meeting, and it was an extremely short, like, introduction to the meeting, kind of like this one was tonight, and they kind of just kind of throw you up there and go, like, okay, share, and I was just like, and I shared about things that I'd never felt like I was going to share about, or it never really painted me in, like, the tough guy light, so I never really wanted to talk about those things. And I talked about stuff that that got me to the point where I was crying at the podium, and I felt so weak at first. And by the end of that meeting, there was this guy that came up to me, and he was like, dude, I'm exactly the same way. You know, oh my God, I've never heard anyone share my story before like that. And that just blew my mind. And I started catching a buzz. Alcoholics Anonymous, doing things like that, and I caught that buzz for a while, and I thought it was just with, like, going to meetings and having great shares, and my sponsor and my grand sponsor at the time had pushed me to, you know, learn how to communicate a little bit more, learn how to communicate at all. Actually, I was going to say to communicate better, but we all got to start somewhere. I really didn't really have that much of an easy starting point, because I had spent most of my life. I never read a book until I got sober. Just played video games and whatnot, watched TV. And my grand sponsor kept on telling me, like, read a book a day, read a book a day. And I'm thinking, this guy's nuts. There's no way I can even read 10 pages in a day. You know, I'm just like, I couldn't imagine it. And if you're wondering how I got through school, I mean, there's things like Spark Notes out there and the great helpful tips and hints and whatnot. And I wound up making amends to my high school with about some of those conduct, that kind of conduct that I was doing before. Not so much, I had to take some things over and do some things over again, but the most important thing that happened there was when I made amends to them, it was more important that I kind of right damaged the fence, you know, mended the fence that I damaged. And I explained to the faculty at that particular institution about, like, how I got away with things and what things they overlooked and whatnot. And I was able to walk away from that, not feeling the best in my life, but I kind of felt a little bit better about it. Looking back at situations in my life today, you know, there's things that today I take for granted. I mean, for one thing, I'm not so bent out of shape about exes anymore, which is, it may not be a big deal to anyone else, but that's a huge deal for a guy like me. And this one particular guy, that bassist in the band today, I mean, I don't like him still. I mean, I never really liked him to begin with. But I don't lie awake anymore at night hating his guts. I'm not lying awake thinking about how I'm going to get back at him. You know, I'm like, ah! You know, and it's like, I could care less. I mean, you know, he's going to live his life screwing over whoever he wants to, and that's fine by me. And that, like I said before, it may not be a big deal to anyone else, but that's amazing to me. And where I'm going with all this was, I started again reaping the rewards and benefits of Alcoholics Anonymous, of taking action that I do not believe in or do not understand, that are not of my own making, and I started feeling better. In fact, I started feeling so good that I thought I'd started doing this all on my own before and didn't really need to listen to my sponsor anymore. I went to college, and my sponsor said, I don't know if you're really ready for that. And I thought, my mom's money is a lot easier than going out to work on my own, so I kept on, so I went to school instead, and so that way they would still support me. And I guess the short of it is when I started dropping out of college, because I wasn't studying anymore, because I was totally undisciplined, of my own making, that my life really started escalating into Alcoholics Anonymous, where I started feeling like I was actually doing the real deal, because I ended up, wound up moving into my sponsor's place at the time, and I started going to, like, afternoon meetings until I got a job. And this one particular afternoon meeting I had to go to encouraged me to get the job even sooner than I wanted to, and I started taking action, and I was living in this household that I was held accountable for my actions. I was held accountable for the things I said and the things that I did. And, I mean, that may not be a shocker to anyone else, but, like, when I grew up, I was, my parents did the best they could with me. I think that's just the most appropriate response I could say. And so when I was living at this house, I absolutely hated it. In fact, I'd go to bed and I just wanted to get back at these guys for, like, hurting my feelings over and over again. I mean, this one guy in particular kept on reminding me that my mom didn't live there, and it just hurt my feelings. And I hated it, and it was the most painful time in my sobriety. And I was like, this is nuts. Why am I doing this? But I kept on doing it. I kept on showing up, and I kept on inconveniencing myself to do Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I mean by that is I worked a job as a stock boy that I hated to make money to pay rent to live where I was. That's not AA. But what I did to inconvenience myself is I would take on the commitment in New York City for the midnight club and the Saturday night. And those were at midnight and 10 p.m. And I would have to usually get up in the next morning. I'd go to the midnight meeting, get home around 2, sleep for 3 hours, get up and go to work the next day. And do that for every weekend. And I would do those things, and I'd take on commitments. And I didn't have a car at the time. I'd get rides from... they usually ended up being newcomers, which was great, because then they were kind of trapped with having to talk with me at some point or another, and it usually gave me a chance to get out of my head before the meeting, and I started going to more speaking commitments, and I started doing these things, and I took on these commitments, and I stopped paying attention to how well I shared, and rather who I was sharing to. And that wasn't out of my own thinking or out of meditation or anything like that. That was like a direct suggestion from my sponsor. And my life started to change because I worked with these two guys from New York City. One of them, I was taking these guys through the steps. I've always been trying to take people through the steps, some more successful than others. But these two particular nut jobs were quite an interesting story. This one guy in particular, he was, he was 5 years sober, couldn't sit still. And he was old enough to be my grandpa. You know, different color skin, you know, completely different. And he wanted me to take him through the steps. And I was like, all right. I kept on asking my sponsor, like, how am I supposed to do this? You know, like, this guy has more time than me. He's going to pull that card and whatnot. But I just kept on showing up and, you know, doing what I normally do when I work with a newcomer. And what happened was I took him through the steps, and I was taking this other guy through the steps that was old enough to be my dad. And he had, like, very little experience in AA before, and, you know, he was a little bit wacky and whatnot, and it was kind of like another side of myself that I saw in him. And I took him through the steps at the same time, and when I got these guys up to the fourth step and the fifth step, and I did a fifth step with these guys, I was completely blown away. I mean, the first guy I described, this old grandpa, I saw things in myself that I had never seen before that he helped me realize. And when I did a fifth step with him, it was on Thanksgiving Day. And we did a fifth step together because even though I was invited to turkey, which would have been my first real meat that I had in a while because I've been living off of, like, ramen and pasta and whatever's cheap, you know, and peanut butter jelly sandwiches. Oh, my God. Ugh. Still cringe every now and then I'm thinking about. But instead of going there, because they said I couldn't bring anyone else with me, and I decided to put this guy's well-being before my own, because my sponsor that day particularly was doing the same thing too. And I couldn't tell him how I abandoned or left the guy sitting around while I went to have turkey dinner. And I just couldn't come up with a good excuse fast enough, so I had to pick up the guy anyways. And so I did a fourth and fifth step with him. And I dropped him off at this nunnery to do a sixth and seventh step, where he sat for an hour and he read a couple of things and prayed. And when I picked him up, I had to like drag him out of there. You know, he was just so, too calm and too relaxed. And he got in the car and we started driving around. And the first thing I noticed, my car stopped shaking. And this guy was like calm and relaxed. And I thought that I had maybe picked up the wrong guy. I was kind of looking at him and I'm like, "Hey, Eugene, what are you thinking about over there?" And he was saying, "You know, I'd never before in my life have been able to look back at my life as if I was looking through a window and not being in the center of it and seeing what I did to hurt other people before. I've never been able to do that." And I just blew my mind. And it wasn't, it's not like I do anything special or anything like that. I just do what's outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first 164 pages of it, at least. And what my experience was, the other guy, when I did his fourth and fifth step, oh boy, that was an interesting night. I ended up doing a speaking commitment in New York City and then hung out with him for like the rest of the day and did this fifth step with him. And I found out a couple more things about myself, and I started hanging out with these guys. And, well, I was not really hanging out with them. I would kind of pick them up because I was able to borrow my mom's car at the time because she was away in Minnesota. She escaped me, so she let me borrow the car. And we'd go to meetings, and we'd go to speaker meetings, and I would get these guys. And since they had just done a fifth step, I would let them speak for like 5 minutes, and I'd share for the rest of the meeting and whatnot. So I was doing to them what my sponsor did to me, and I felt happy about it, and I felt enthused about it, and I started realizing that my life isn't all that bad. And it was crazy, because even though I still hated my job, I mean, I felt like I at least could show up for it, and even though I didn't really like most of the people that I was spent time with, I should say, being able to work with other alcoholics made it bearable in life. We went to this one particular meeting that I didn't want to be at because it was a 2 a.m. meeting. Had to work the next day, and it was on speaking on step six. Just six by itself. I couldn't talk about any other step. There was a lot of guidelines to the particular meeting. And I was sitting in the meeting, and I looked around, and I saw some people I just didn't like. And I thought this was going to be a bad meeting. And I'm looking around, and I'm all agitated, I'm all nervous, and I just don't feel good. And I'm hanging out, and I see the two guys I'm working with, and they're just kidding around. They're just kicking back and just laughing and joking around. And before, when I met them, they were like totally antisocial, couldn't like, you know, they looked like they were about to jump out the window at first, you know. But now I saw them, and they were all relaxed, and they were actually happy, and I was just like, oh my God, well, at least they might get something out of it. And I had the worst talk of my life, and I made a total dork of myself, which is actually kind of normal. But I didn't care about that, because I wasn't there for the meeting. I wasn't there to sound good. I wasn't there to impress anyone. I was there to help those guys out. And those are the principles that I started living my life today, and I still live them today. And I'm realizing I have only a couple minutes to share about this stuff, but where my life's at today is that, you know, I've been working in the jewelry business for a while, which, I have to tell you, at first I thought it was a bad idea. But I needed a job of any sort, because the jewelry business, they're very focused and very detail-oriented, and I'm just kind of a guy that goes like, yeah, whatever, just whatever. And it forced me to do things that I just wasn't comfortable with, and then I kept on staying at the job, and from my advice from my sponsor, I started investing more effort into the job when I told him that I didn't like it anymore. He didn't say get another job, he said do more. And that's the one thing my sponsors always said in my sobriety, is like take more action, help more people. And it always seems to work, and whether in rough going or not. And now I'm still in the job, and I no longer hate it. I'm actually really excited about things. I'm doing things that I never thought I was able to do before, and the life I live today is something that I do not deserve. And so because I do not deserve it, what I try to do on a daily basis, I try to find some way that I at least help one person out each day. Or at least be able to go to bed at night where I felt like I gave more than I took. And those are concepts that my sponsor had instilled on me. And through strong sponsorship, I mean, an example of my strong sponsorship was we were driving back home from a commitment down somewhere on Parkway South, and we're driving up, and I had noticed my sponsor was texting at the time while he was driving, saving some poor soul out there in life. And we were driving in the right lane, and this car was merging over from the right, and he was kind of getting kind of close to me, you know, so I was nervous. I was like, "Hey, Jim, watch out for this idiot on the right." And he looks over at me and goes, "Oh, don't worry, Eric, I see you." And just kept on driving. I mean, that's the kind of strong sponsorship that I have had in my life, where my sponsor really doesn't care about my feelings. He cares more about my life and about my actions and about things that I say than things that I do. And, you know, my life is good today, and it's a direct result of strong sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous. So with that, I'd like to thank you for helping me stay sober another day.
Thank you, Eric, and...